Hello and welcome back. This is Greg Kelly. This is the podcast. And growing up, I always had very strong, fond feelings for our government, the United States government. I mean, what could go wrong? These are good people. This is our government. This is America. We're so much better than the Soviet Union. That's what we were worried about back then. And we don't have that worry anymore. Well, kind of, sort of, and a different one with China. Anyway, that's not the point. The point is, I don't trust vast portions of the government. Too much power, too many people unaccountable, too many folks that we did not elect in positions of vast influence. And I think too many of them are serving themselves and not us. And some of them are malicious. I do believe that. Our guest today, Karen Turk. She is a former beauty queen, actually, and she happens to be quite beautiful. A Mrs. Florida. She became a conservative talk show host and wrote an extraordinary book called Behind the Headlines, How a Conservative Beauty Queen Became the Target of Fake News and Cancel Culture. You'll hear in a moment. I think she is a very good person. I think she... what happened to her, though, could happen to just about anybody. If you annoy, make mad the wrong person, your life could be turned upside down by the government. You'll see. I think she was just trying to be a good daughter to her mother, who was in decline and in the care of a nursing home. You'll hear all about that in a moment. Her book, though, I also think it's very important for us to buy books from conservatives, of conservatives. Let's face it, big tech, the system, it's all about supporting the left, and we have to support each other. So I'll talk about that book with her and also at the end of this. So you're going to like her story. She's very impressive. And again, what happened to her, I think, could happen to just about anybody. And we have to be vigilant, and we have to know our rights, and we have to be strong, and I think we have to call this abuse out that you'll hear about in a moment. Government abuse, overreach, prosecutorial abuse. That's what happened here, I believe. In the meantime, our sponsor today is D'Espresso Liber. These folks make awesome coffee, and it's made by patriots, all right? They believe in hard work, self-determination, and individual liberty. As they say, freedom does not brew itself. And that's why I drink D'Espresso Liber, founded by a Green Beret almost a decade ago, who developed a dedication to crafting outstanding brews after multiple deployments. Now, D'Espresso Liber coffee is 100% Arabica coffee, all right? Sourced from the finest coffee farms from around the world. It is roasted fresh in-house once they receive your order. All right. Now, the D'Espresso Liber experience starts from the moment you open the package. The aroma is very, very tantalizing. Okay. You can actually smell it as soon as you open the box, and it's fantastic stuff. I'm growing quite sophisticated when it comes to coffee. I used to drink anything they put in front of me, and I didn't even know how I liked it. Now I'm very, very particular. D'Espresso Liber coffee is very tasty. It's full-bodied. It's smooth. And it gives me a delicious jump start to the day. All right? It is rich in flavor and American values. D'Espresso Liber coffee encourages all of us to sit down together and unite with fellow patriots to celebrate our God-given rights. Now, just visit D'Espresso Liber. That's D'Espresso Liber. D'Espresso Liber.com. Now, I know it's a lot, all right? D'Espresso Liber. One more time, okay? D-E, espresso, the word espresso, D-E and then espresso, E-S-P-R-E-S-S-O, Liber. Some people take liberties in the pronunciation of it. Technically, it's Liber, by the way, but a lot of people have their own interpretation. Liber.com, D'Espresso Liber, D-E-E-S-P-R-E-S-S-O-L-I-B-E-R.com. You're going to love the experience, and actually, you can reach out to them on the website and give a review. I think you'll love not only the coffee, but the people behind the coffee. All right. So many thanks for that. In the meantime, our conversation with the former Mrs. Florida, Karen Turk. What is the, we all know the Miss America contest. We know the Miss USA contest. What's the Mrs. Version of that?
Yeah, you know, I didn't know any of this either before you get into pageants. Like, you assume that there's just, you know, there's Miss America, there's this. But the truth is there's hundreds of pageants all over the country every year, and there's different sectors. So I was Mrs. Florida, which is the U.S. continental version of their pageant, which is a Mrs. pageant, which is obviously for someone who's married, a little bit older, you know, not a Miss America or a Miss Florida. It's a Mrs. Florida.
Is it the same affiliation, like the same company runs it as Miss America or not?
No, there's a bunch of them. Miss America's one. I was part of U.S. Continental. So that was the pageant group that was behind the pageant that I competed in. But it all started, I mean, I can talk about this too. It all started at a charity event. I actually had a girl who had competed in multiple pageants. And at the time I was doing a lot of like philanthropic charity work. I had a bunch of nonprofits I was working with. And she just said, you know, you should do this because you could win and I'll help you. And she was so cool. And I had like three glasses of wine in me. So I said, told everybody at the table, I'm going to do this. I'm going to compete in this pageant. And the next day my husband was like, are you really doing this? And I'm like, well, I just told an entire room of people that I am. So, you know, now I'm in. And it was a great experience. It really was. It wasn't something that I was ever exposed to. I grew up, I'm a, you know, a Jewish girl from New Jersey. I grew up in a basically in an Orthodox Jewish community. So this was so outside of my comfort zone, but it taught me a lot. And it was a really great thing.
Do you have to do, you know, is it like a talent thing? Is it a swimsuit thing as well? What are the categories?
Yeah, I got lucky because this particular pageant group, especially because it's a Mrs., was heavily weighted on the interview. So I went in and just, you know, the six judges were amazing. And I went in with like a business plan of how I wanted to use my title and my platform over the year. And thankfully, that was in my wheelhouse. So I didn't have to do, you know, the typical talent stuff, like you talk about paying a piano. You know, we had an evening gown competition. We had a fitness wear competition. And, you know, all in all, the interview was 33% of the score. So that was really what pushed me over, is I nailed the interview portion.
So, like, if you meet somebody at a party right now, somebody who does not know who you are, somebody, you say you're in New York or maybe a small town somewhere, and they're like, okay, Well, what do you do for a living? What do you say?
Oh, well, I'm a correspondent for Real America's Voice. You know, I'm back to doing mostly TV stuff now. So, I mean, that's my real public career right now. So if somebody asked me that, I'd say, you know, I'm a correspondent for Real America's Voice. But a lot of people know me as Mrs. Florida, obviously, because of the national headlines and the story and, you know, all the craziness that's been a part of my life since Donald Trump took office. Let's call it what it is.
And tell us a little bit about Real America's Voice and what you do there.
Real America's Voice is amazing. We are really like the voice of the people. You know, there's a lot of stations out there. And I work with Newsmax. I work with a lot of different stations. But Real America's Voice, I'm really growing with them. And we have a bunch of shows on our network that are great shows. You know, Dr. Gina's on our channel. Steve Bannon's on our channel. You know, I'm on the channel. There's going to be some really exciting people lined up. But we're really just trying to elevate the voice of the people, to really be a news outlet that reflects where America's at, you know, not the mainstream media narrative. And like other great, like Newsmax and Fox, and, you know, I don't know about Fox so much anymore, but, you know, there's a lot of them out there. Right Side Broadcasting is doing a great job.
And you're as a correspondent, what do you do? What do you focus on and how do you present?
I speak mostly on politics. That's mostly my, you know, my wheelhouse. I talk a lot about, you know, what's going on in America, the current state of America, and really things from a conservative female standpoint. You know, I think a lot of times, you know, we talk about, you know, the suburban mom and what, you know, what the suburban mom thinks. Well, I am a suburban mom and I can tell you what I think. And I think sometimes things are misconstrued. So I try to be a voice for other people that maybe don't have the public platform that I have.
Look, behind the headlines, how a conservative beauty queen became the target of fake news and cancel culture. How did that happen? Why did they come after you?
I think they came after me for a variety of reasons. The number one reason is because I was speaking up against the court corruption and things that I had witnessed, having my mother be put into a very litigious guardianship after, you know, really standing up for her as an elderly woman who was in a nursing home. You know, I made decisions that as a daughter, which at the time I thought were good decisions, but looking back, I would have made a lot of decisions very differently. But I realized that the guardianship system was ridiculously corrupted in Palm Beach County, Florida, and that, you know, there was problems that needed to be exposed as far as the neglect that my mother was experiencing. I had been fighting with them for years. So the nursing home basically went ahead and hired a law firm that was notoriously known for guardianship. And what we have in the guardianship system is we have an ability for legal predators, and they're legal, they're not doing anything illegal, I'm not insinuating, predators who come in and are basically able to profit off of elderly people. And I ended up in a situation with my mom where I didn't see that coming. I didn't realize that that was how the game was played. I thought that the lawyers that were coming forward and initiating a guardianship for my mother, I thought a guardianship would be, you know, a good thing for a family because we needed help fighting against the nursing home that was abusing my mom. And I thought the guardian was going to be an advocate, was going to be somebody who was going to have my mother's best interests at heart. And I should have trusted my gut, and I made a million mistakes. And unfortunately, my mom ended up dying, you know, in the hands of a guardianship in a nursing home that did neglect her. And I had no control over it because my civil rights had been stripped along with hers in a guardianship proceeding. And if I went back and knew what I knew today, you know, I would try to educate everybody. Unfortunately, the Free Britney movement is doing that.
So first, where did you grow up? New Jersey, you said?
I grew up in Teaneck, New Jersey. I grew up right outside of New York City. I grew up in a heavily Orthodox community and, you know, lived a really great childhood. I'm adopted. I was adopted at 6 years old. It's a really beautiful backstory between two families that came together and, you know, had a 15-year-old girl who was pregnant, decided to make the right decision for me and placed me with my parents, who will always be my parents. And I had an amazing life growing up right outside of New York.
But you were six. What happened? Who were you with those?
Six days old.
Oh, I'm
six
sorry.
Days old.
Phew.
Yeah,
okay.
Old.
I thought you were 6 years old. All right.
No, 6 days old. They, my entire adoption was arranged before I was born. The two families knew each other, and it was a mutual effort to make sure that they did the right thing by me. And, you know, I'm surprised that in this country we don't talk more about adoption. I always try to say to myself, you know, adoption is an option, because had that not been my situation, you know, my life could be entirely different, and maybe not in a great way. Maybe it would have been fabulous too, but I'm thankful and blessed every day that these people came together and made a choice of love for me.
You you know your birth mother? Or you knew your birth mother?
I do. I actually met her when I was 20 years old. My mom really was somebody who is enormously curious about what had become of this 15-year-old girl. And, you know, when I was 18, I don't think that I entirely had that in perspective. You know, my mom was pushing me to find her. And, you know, it made me feel a little bit awkward at 18. Like, what do I do? Like, you know, is my relationship with my parents going to change? You know, what's the expectation? What's this person going to be like? But I had my daughter at 19. And as soon as I had my daughter, I really knew that I wanted to find her. And we ended up finding her and we reunited and she became a part of my family. You know, my parents, up until, you know, they both passed, they absolutely adored her. And she's in a wonderful, amazing woman. And a product of all of these people. You know, there's so many things in our life that, you know, are environmental and some that are biological, I think, that you don't even think about, just personality traits and things about me that are a part of this person that I didn't meet until I was 20. It's a really amazing thing.
Was she Jewish as well, your birth mother?
She is now. She's been in and out. She actually was Christian at one time, too. She's been all over with her personal spiritual journey, but part of her family is Jewish. Part of them are Christian.
So growing up, brothers, sisters in Teaneck?
Just me, the one and only, yeah.
And what did your parents do?
My dad was an engineer. My dad was, my dad actually was, you know, part of the Greatest Generation. I think it's really amazing. Both of my parents actually escaped the Nazis in Austria. So my father was 11, my mom was 6. And every day, you know, it's probably why, you know, I look at political viewpoints and things that the way that I do today, and what's shaped me is really that, you know, my parents came here escaping, you know, socialism and escaping then, you know, the Nazi invasion as Jews. And my father was 11. He came here. He didn't speak a word of English. He ended up learning English, went to the Bronx High School of Math and Science, or the New York High School of Math and Science in the Bronx. They ended up living in Washington Heights. And my father ended up in Cornell on a full scholarship at the age of 15. So he was a really incredible human being. And he ended up being a plastics engineer for part of his career. And he had worked with the Department of Defense, and he fought in Korea, and was an Army veteran.
Wow. Yeah. I take it he died. When did he die?
He did. He died. He died several years ago, but prior to my mom. And, you know, I feel like my mom died in some ways from a broken heart. My parents were together for 47 years. So, you know, my parents were, you know, real traditionalists. You know, they consider themselves Democrats because they were Jewish. And when I was about 7, I realized that, you know, I was interested in politics, which was pretty young to realize that you were. But my dad was a real history buff, and he loved politics. And my mom was a civil rights activist. She was really amazing. My mom was, you know, someone who came here at 6 years old, who, you know, learned the language just like my dad did, who, you know, became a proud American, lived in Brooklyn, grew up in Brooklyn in a, you know, a very Jewish household. And she went on to think that she wanted to be a teacher. And prior to me being born, she was teaching. But, you know, after I was born, my mom really became a stay-at-home mom, and she volunteered her time to teach English to immigrants, among other things. And she was a dedicated volunteer. But when I was a kid, she was a civil rights activist. And she always considered herself a liberal. And I remember when Jimmy Carter was running, knowing that I wanted Ronald Reagan to win. And that was, I was on Team Reagan. And my parents thought it was really cute. My father would say, you know, look at our little Republican. But my parents were really conservative, although they were Democrats. But I think the Democratic Party has really, really changed over the years.
Is that your earliest political memory? You said you were 7. That would have been about the time. Yeah, Reagan Carter, right?
Yeah, that's my earliest political memory. And I could tell you exactly what happened is, you know, there had been a lot of discussions about this in my home, and my New York Times to me every morning. It was actually, he took a lot of pride in teaching me how to read when I was really young. It's one of the benefits of being an adopted child of older parents. You know, I was this product as an only child of an adult environment. So I think it's lent a lot to who I am today. And my father would read the New York Times, and I knew what was going on in the election. I remember going to, and this is in my book, I remember going to Central Park with my mom and my aunt. And my mom, you know, we were fighting over buying these marionette puppets, which I really wanted really badly. And my mom said, you can have one, but you have to get the peanut one if you're going to get one. And they were like $20, which was a lot of money at the time. And I acquiesced and said, okay, to the peanut puppet. But I knew it represented Jimmy Carter. And I was a little bit upset about it, although I was really happy to have the puppet. But, you know, that is probably, my earliest political memory is really, you know, Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan and the excitement over that election and just what was going on in my household from a child's perspective.
What was your dad's name?
My dad's name was Joe Schaefer.
And your mother?
My mom was Ilsa.
All right. So you go to high school, Teaneck High School, by any chance?
I did not go to Teaneck High School. We actually moved away for a little while. My father was offered a job out in Hackettstown, New Jersey, and which to my parents was in the middle of nowhere. You would have thought that we were moving to like the plains of Kansas.
Uh-oh, I'm sorry. You broke up for a minute.
My mom didn't drive, so we ended up moving back to Bergen County, and I went to Dumont High School. So I lived in Dumont for a while.
And what were you like in high school?
I don't know. I think you'd have to ask the people I went to high school with. My high school experience was great. I had a good group of girlfriends that we were pretty tight and we hung together. I worked a lot. I worked at the mall. I worked at a store called J. Riggings when I was a kid, which doesn't exist anymore, and sold men's suits and spent a lot of time with my girlfriends down the shore, and we had a really tight group. We're actually still friends to this day. We just had a 50th birthday for one of my best friends, Melissa, in Dumont just a couple months ago, and had a blast.
Where did you go to college?
I went to Florida Southern. I went to Florida Southern in Lakeland. So that was after I had kids. I had kids really young. So I was a working mom. I had my daughter, very young. I was actually 18, just going on 19. And, then I went on to have kids. I have four kids. So I was having kids through, most of my 20s and my 30s.
Did you get married young?
I did. I've been married three times, so I'm on my third marriage now. I finally got it right. But I met a guy, when I was living in Dumont. He was from Bergenfield. It was, small town New Jersey, USA, and, thought that he would be a good husband because, all of our friends hung out together. That was really, the 80s in New Jersey. I guess my life and my perspective was pretty small. So we got married, we had kids, and I'm thankful for that, but it didn't work out. And then I got married the second time to a really great guy that I met in Florida, and we had a lot in common, but we were both very type A, and things didn't work out, and we had our son together, and now I'm married for the third time, no kids at the time.
Just a dog. On that real
just
quick,
a dog.
if you were going to give advice to somebody younger who like what makes a successful marriage? What makes a marriage fall apart? Just anything off the top of your head.
Patience. I think I had a lack of patience when I was younger. I think I'm a lot more patient now. I think it's probably the one quality that I have that I've learned about myself that I need to be a more patient person.
Patient for what? Like, what were you rushing for him to achieve? Professionally or for things around the house, what were you impatient about?
I think probably part of it comes from, you've asked me about my childhood and there's a lot about my childhood in my book Behind the Headlines. I think a lot of it was that, I was an only child. I grew up, without any siblings. I probably lacked some of the skills to be able to compromise if I could find, something that, I would go back and I would do differently. But I don't know if it would have saved either of those two marriages. I mean, don't get me wrong. I don't think that was necessarily, I think I was, my picker was a little bit off. I think I didn't know really what I expected out of a relationship or what I needed for myself. So I think I got married the first time way too early. Although, it pains me to say that because I have kids. So I don't want to, in any way negate, what a beautiful blessing having kids was. But if I could go back and have a different life and do things differently and maybe make some different choices, I probably wouldn't get married so young because I don't think you really know yourself.
Do you think being an only child had something to do with it? Like, that's my sense. I mean, look, it's an advantage to have siblings. It's a mm-hmm. disadvantage to not have them for a number of reasons. Do you think that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
I would agree with that. Yeah, for sure. I think even raising my kids, and all my kids now are older, again, I was, I hate to give away my age, but I'm 49. So, when I look back on things now and I think about it, I've gone through this whole lifetime. I now have adult children and I look at things from a very different perspective than I did when I was younger. And I for sure think that even their relationships with each other, I have a hard time understanding because I've never had siblings. I wasn't raised in that environment. So even watching my kids interact to me sometimes is interesting because I think the way that they communicate is effective, but the way that they get there isn't necessarily something that I can relate to.
So your 20s and 30s are spent primarily in New Jersey?
No, I lived in Florida for a while. I actually moved to Florida in my early 20s. I wanted to work and go to school, and it just seemed like a better decision. And I lived right outside of Orlando. I actually worked for Hooters, little known fact. I was a Hooters waitress, and I knew that I could just have a better quality of life. And I was, tired of the cold and tired of being in New Jersey. And I felt like with my first husband that, maybe we'd get along better if we were outside of like the tri-state area and if we got away from everything. And I didn't travel to go away to college. So I missed that experience. So when I moved to Florida, I really wanted to focus on, building my career and, going to school and trying to juggle, being a parent. And that's exactly what happened. And that's really was, what the course of my life for several years. And then my first husband enticed me to go back to New Jersey because he had some job opportunities there and thought that it would be a better environment for the kids. And I gave it a shot for a while, but it really wasn't what I wanted. And I ended up working for a publishing company and they offered me a job in Florida. And thank God I came down here 21 years ago and it was the best decision I ever made.
Real back to college. What did you major in? I know you were going kind of part-time, but what did you major in?
Marketing.
And
Marketing. Business administration of marketing.
And the job they offered you is what?
The job that they offered me
at the printing exactly.
Oh,
yeah.
I actually was a sales manager. I was a sales manager for advertising salespeople. Because I had done that. I had done that before when I was going to school, and when I lived in New Jersey, I had done some advertising sales. So that's what I did. I was a marketing director.
So,
and I ran salespeople throughout the country.
And so great. Life is beautiful. You're raising your family in Florida. And how long were you with that firm?
I worked for them, until the early 2000s. And then, I went on to other things. I had a marketing company for a while as an independent contractor. And I ended up working with CBS Radio was one of my clients. And I worked with them for a while. And then they ended up offering me a job. And I went to work there. And I had a really great career with them as well.
What did you do for CBS Radio?
I was a marketing director for 5 of the radio stations down here in South Florida.
And what does that entail when you're a marketing executive for radio stations? What do you actually do?
It's actually a lot. You know, it's running promotions and events. We had a department called non-traditional revenue, and in our non-traditional revenue department, we did things like events and found opportunities for sponsorship for our advertisers. So it was going back to my roots of really advertising sales, but bringing it more into, you know, a managerial position and with a lot more moving parts. It was challenging. It was great. I will forever be thankful because they're really what inspired me to get on the radio and get in front of the camera. You know, before that, a lot of what I had done had been really behind the scenes. And it was working there that really inspired me that I could have a voice and that I could, you know, do radio and get in front of the camera. And, you know, I was working with people behind the scenes, helping them do that. But, you know, it was really what inspired me to start to do that for myself.
Well, what were your first like on-air roles? What did you do?
I had done acting really throughout, you know, most of my life in one degree or another. So that had always been a part of it. So I actually started by doing voiceovers for commercials with them. And I did some really, really cool commercials. That was really my first, you know, stint on radio. And, you know, of course, I played the tri-state area, you know, Jewish lady who was yelling at her husband, because that would be stereotypical for my voice. And I did a couple commercials, and I just had some DJs there that were really nice to me and would have me come in and comment on different things on the radio. And that was really where it grew from.
So, and where did it go to? Like, where did you take that? Where did that go? How did that progress?
I think that you mean being on air? I think it progressed really just naturally. It wasn't something that I was necessarily, it wasn't the main part of my career, but it just happened, especially because as my marketing business grew, I started to take on, you know, media crisis clients, because I had worked in the media, you know, with CBS and previously, you know, in advertising, and I knew the market. So I ended up working with clients that needed help with media. So that was really something that, you know, where those talents sort of came together and were able to pay off. So that was when it sort of started to evolve into having more of a voice for myself.
All right. So things are going along well professionally. You're raising your family. And is this where your mother at some point starts to have health issues?
Yeah. I mean, that was much later. Yeah, that was, you know, really when I was working at CBS, my mom, you know, that was when I started to get the phone calls. And, you know, as a caregiver, as a daughter, you know, we all experience this as you age. I mean, most of us do if we're lucky enough to have parents. I started getting the phone calls from my mom where she was confused. She had missed the bus. You know, she, you know, had lost her phone. You know, different things started to happen that started to lead me to believe that I needed to become more involved in my parents' care. And at the time, you know, I really feel like I got very lucky. It was, you know, God really intervened in a couple of ways. And the first way that was CBS Radio was being sold, and they were working on the deal to sell the radio station. So I knew that eventually, you know, I would be able to, you know, move on and have more flexibility. So all of that was sort of happening at the same time. So it allowed me the opportunity to go up to Connecticut and, you know, visit with my parents more and figure out what was going on and figure out what my next move was going to be. Because I was already living in Florida. I knew they couldn't stay by themselves. And my father had been diagnosed with myelodysplasia, which is a blood disorder where, you know, you have to get blood transfusions. Your body doesn't produce red blood cells. So my dad was at the point where he was having regular blood transfusions. And it was becoming really difficult. He was still working at that time. He worked for Elizabeth Arden, which was a cosmetic company, and he had a job, you know, working with their ingredients and, you know, on the, you know, the engineering chemical side. You know, that was my dad. And, you know, he was still working with them and didn't want to give that up and was trying to juggle it. And I just could see that things were getting really difficult for them. And I started going up there, and every time I would come up, there would be, you know, a new dent in the car or something my mom would tell me that concerned me. And finally, I sat my father down and I said, I don't know how long you have left. You know, I don't know how long you can keep up getting blood transfusions. And, you know, he knew that things were getting bad, and his oncologist was telling him, you know, I don't know, you know, how much longer, you know, you may have a year, you may have 6 months. So at that point, we made the decision to, you know, bring them to Florida, and they came to Florida, and it was amazing because my kids got to be with them and I got to be with them. And I hired private duty aides, and I had them in an independent facility, you know, living as much as I could emulate their independence before. You know, I had to take the cars away and do all of the things that we have to do that are so incredibly difficult as a child and a caregiver. But I had them in a place where I felt like things were really good for them. And I got to spend a lot of time with them. So that was a blessing in it all. But once my father died, things really fell apart. My mom was not able to take care of herself. It was incredible to me just how when you have two people together as a couple, which is a really beautiful thing, you know, they really become so reliant on each other. But even more than that, you know, once my father wasn't there, my mom, just her entire mental state changed, and her Alzheimer's started to.
Hey,
cameras up in her apartment.
Sorry, okay, you broke up for a minute. Yeah. Her Alzheimer's, and then you broke up. Tell me about her Alzheimer's.
Yeah, her.
Oh my goodness, you're breaking up again.
Calling it dementia at that time, whether it's, you know, Alzheimer's or dementia, it's the same effect. So she was becoming more forgetful and things were becoming more difficult. And I ended up moving her into a smaller apartment at another place because I thought that, you know, it might be more manageable. And this time I put cameras up so I could watch my mom at night, so I could make sure if the aide left that my mom was okay. And for every reason at that point, I felt that she still was, until I witnessed her falling. And at that point, she ended up in the hospital. And I listened to the professionals and I listened to the recommendations of the social workers. And I, you know, went against my gut a little bit, and I allowed them to release her into a facility, which ultimately ended up being the facility that, you know, not only took her life in some respect, but also allowed her to be placed into this horrific guardianship that stripped both of our rights and really, you know, took her life in the end.
How did you find the facility where you put her?
You know, it was a number of things. The hospital made recommendations. They actually told me to go look at a number of facilities, and it was one of a number of facilities that I had looked at. And then, you know, I remember talking to my husband about it, and, you know, we made some phone calls to different people and got some recommendations. But really, the way that I picked the facilities, I picked the facility. I was the one who did it. I walked in there and I thought it was small. It seemed a little bit homier than some of the other facilities because it was smaller, and it was run by these Finnish women, and they all had these Finnish accents, and it just, to me, seemed, it worked at that moment. It seemed to be the right decision, and I blame myself for it because I wish I would have done more homework, and I would have maybe, you know, called ACA, you know, which runs the, you know, the nursing homes and regulates them throughout, you know, the state of Florida and probably other states as well. But I didn't at the time. I made a decision, and I felt uneasy about everything at that point. So, you know, no matter what decision I was going to make, I didn't know that it was going to be the right one, but I made a decision, and I'll in some ways forever regret that decision.
When did things start going south? When did you realize, okay, this is not working out?
You know, probably, you know, I realized it wasn't working out probably a few months in, because I felt that the facility wasn't listening to me. And I had noticed that my mother's decline, you know, originally when I put my mom in the facility and when the hospital made this recommendation that she needed to be released to a full scale facility because my mom wasn't walking and she wasn't doing the things that she was doing previous to the fall and ending up in the hospital. So they were saying she needed physical therapy and she needed round-the-clock care. And that wasn't something I was going to be able to provide in my home. And I felt like they were going to rehabilitate her. I thought she would go into this facility and that they would rehabilitate my mom. And maybe in some ways that might have been somewhat realistic, but I thought she was going to be in an environment where they were going to be making an effort to get her better. And I didn't realize that that's not really the way that these facilities work from what I've seen. The way that it works is your parent goes in and your parent is going to decline. And after, you know, several months, maybe 6 or 7 months, I noticed that my mom was declining and I was concerned about the different medications they had her on. And I started to talk to the doctors and I started to ask questions and I was met with a lot of resistance. And that was when I started to really feel uneasy about the situation my mom was in, when I felt that my needs weren't being responded to as well as hers. And I had private duty aides in and out of the facility. So I had other eyes and ears because I couldn't be there all the time. But I really wasn't necessarily supposed to do that in the type of facility she was in. And they had told me basically that, you know, my private duty aides needed to, you know, be in and out and not interfere with the other patients and all these things. But in hindsight, I look back on that and I wonder to myself, was it just because they didn't want another person who was going to report back to me and tell me that they weren't taking care of my mom? And at that time, I was getting, you know, feedback from them and from my daughters that things weren't good. And it got progressively worse. And my daughters would come back because I have adult kids. They're in and out of the facility, too. And they're coming to me and like, Mom, you got to, you know, you got to talk to them. They got to do better by grandma. And, you know, I was making an effort. But the louder I got and the more I created resistance, the uglier things got in their fight. And that's when they ended up hiring the law firm.
Now, did you think about, well, why don't they just find another facility? Let's get her out of here.
It's not so simple because at that point, my mom had, you know, I was not in a position that I had been, you know, previously. You know, there weren't assets. There weren't a lot of things to work with. I had to work within a budget and I had to put my mom somewhere where I felt I could afford to also have some private care for her, you know, in the interim until we figured out what this long term looked like. And those seemed like very good decisions at the time. And I don't know that if I went back, I would change any of that because I didn't know what I didn't know. And having her in the facility very quickly, I realized that, you know, it was getting bad really, really fast. And they were blaming it on the decline of the disease and other things. But, you know, it was evident to me that there were other factors at play and that medication was probably playing a role. And, you know, as a daughter, again, I know my mom, kids know my mom. We're the people who knew my mom. These outsiders didn't know my mom. So we were the ones that really needed to be fighting for her. So once they hired the law firm, things really went sideways.
Now, what year is this?
This was, let's say, probably 2017.
And they hired the law firm to do what?
They hired the law firm because they had my mother listed as Medicaid pending. And when I put her in the facility, they had told me that they could get my mother approved for Medicaid. That, you know, at this point, I'm in a situation where if my mom's going to need round-the-clock care, it's not going to be something that's going to be affordable for her, for me, for anybody. So I decided to let them proceed with the Medicaid applications. And they were supposed to be working with me on that and doing that. And I was complying with everything that they were asking, but it wasn't getting done. And then at that point, you know, I had decided that, you know, I was going to possibly move my mom somewhere else. So I started to call other facilities. I called, you know, facilities in Boynton Beach and other places close by and started to consult with them. But nobody would take my mom because of her status, because nobody wants a patient that's being paid for by Medicaid. They private funds. So I was having a really hard time moving my mom. And that was right around the time that the lawyers got involved and right around the time things got ugly. But had I known, I would have never put my mom on Medicaid pending. I would have found a way. Maybe I would have brought her home with me. I don't know what decision I would have made. I certainly wouldn't have put her in this facility.
And I'm sorry, but what was the law firm actually trying to do again? What were they were brought in to do, accomplish
the
what?
The way the guardianship system works, so you understand, and I think your listeners also need to understand is, you know, this is a very profitable system in our courts. The probate system is a system of profit. And basically, you have attorneys that are profiting from putting people in guardianships. And a lot of times there will be a guardian inside of this facility. And I can't really get into the specifics of what happened in my particular case. But I can tell you that I've talked to hundreds of families around the country. And I did settle. So, you know, the unlawful death suit, I did sue the nursing home for unlawful death of my mother. And that case was settled by the nursing home with me. So as the PR of the estate, that case was settled. My mother died with 9 bed sores, eating away her flesh after being put in a guardianship. So when you're in a situation where you start to argue with your siblings, and in some ways being an only child hurt me here, but it doesn't change anything as far as the big picture. If you're fighting with your brother about how to care for your mom, any law firm can come in and can initiate a guardianship over your mother and take your mother away from you and your brother or you and your sibling, regardless of estate planning, regardless of everything that you think that you've done that matters. If a court of law wants to appoint a guardian and a lawyer initiates that guardianship in the state of Florida and many other states across this country, your parent ends up in guardianship. And it sounds ridiculous and it sounds illogical when I say it, but this happens every single day all over our country. There's $3.5 billion in assets that are floating around that are being controlled in guardianship in this country every year.
Do me a favor. Can you define
a highly profitable system?
I understand. Can you define guardian? I mean, we think we know what it is, but technically, what is guardianship?
Guardianship is basically making somebody a ward of the state. And by becoming a ward of the state, the person becomes indigent. They become completely owned. Their civil rights are completely taken away from them. And they are now somebody else's property. They belong to that guardian. That guardian makes all decisions for them, medical, financial. And you can have different types of guardianships. You can have just a medical guardianship or just a financial guardianship. But for the most part, it means that someone's civil rights are completely taken from them, and they have now become the property of another.
Now, around this time, 2017, are you active politically? Are you?
Yes.
You're becoming like a trailblazer.
I'm Mrs. Florida 2016. So my crown, my reign was 2016 to 2017. So this is all around the same time.
But that's not a political post, or is it?
Well, it is. It is when you're Mrs. Florida and you're being extremely vocal about your opinion for Donald Trump running for president, and you're out there, you know, with your sash and your crown at different events, supporting the president and supporting his political campaign. So it did become political for me. And at that time, Mrs. Florida didn't have anything in their contracts or in their bylaws that said that I couldn't be a political personality. And it didn't happen because I was looking to become a political personality. It happened because I was passionate about winning an election and watching our country be rebuilt, because I could see where our country was headed. And I, as a mother and as an American, was unhappy about what I saw.
Is the pageant company, are they upset? Are they freaked out by your political profile?
I don't know. They've never actually talked to me about it. I don't know what their feelings are, but I did hear a rumor, and I don't know this is true, but I had somebody who told me that they had signed up for the pageant and that there's actually a clause in their contract now that they can volunteer for any organization as long as it's a non-political organization.
Okay. So how does the heat is being applied? What do they do? Ugly.
Let me start by saying too that you need to understand that in the world of politics and in the world of our legal system, everything is interconnected. Our legal system and our political system are groups of people that are socially connected, that are economically connected. This is the reality in America. This is the reality. I'm not singling out Democrats or Republicans here. It is a small community when you're running in either Republican circles or Democrat circles. You know, it is a division in this country. It does exist. And the attorney.
Wait, a division, that, a division, a division between whom? A division between what?
Between the two parties and between people's ideals and what they believe in. And
sure.
I'm bringing this up for a reason. You know, you have to understand that when you ask me about, you know, how is the guardianship politically tied? I want to leave some of this. You need to read the book because it's all in the book. But the lawyers actually who came after my mother and placed my mother in a guardianship, their family has been tied. The matriarch or the patriarch of this family has been tied to the Democrat Party going back to the turn of the century. So the lawyers that came after me are politically tied on the other side of the aisle. This is a reality. I'm not saying that they came after my mom because of that, but was there an opportunity to paint me as a Trump supporter? Was there an opportunity for people that were on the other side of the aisle to hate me because who I was and because what I stood up for? Absolutely.
Okay, wait, just let me just jump in here. Yes, but I mean, look, you're in Florida. It's a swing state. There are...
No, it's a swamp.
Okay, swamp, but I mean, there are Democrats and Republicans, right?
There are both.
How, I mean, like, well, number one, how active and vocal were you? I mean, as Mrs. Florida.
I was pretty active and pretty vocal.
Yeah,
I'm
sure.
I was pretty active and pretty vocal.
But, I mean, how many people are going to really notice that? I mean, like, what did you do? And how, are you convinced, do you know that that really got their attention and they decided to use that against you?
I mean, all you have to do is read the headlines of every single headline that's ever been run about me. Every single headline that's been run about me has said something about Mrs. Florida or Roger Stone for the most part. And yeah, they definitely use my political position and there's no way around that. And I hope that, you know, the people listening to this will consider reading the book because the book opens up exactly why that is. And it's going to be too much for me to tie together on the show for you today. But I can tell you that the lawyers who... you know, were the ones who initiated the guardianship. My mother were heavily tied to the Democrat Party. There's a lot of things that came into play during depositions. There were letters that came out. There were written to Democrat Congress people, you know, about the type of treatment I should get as a Trump supporter. There were a lot of things that happened. So, you know, this definitely was political. It was definitely personal. And who I was and what I represented was attacked all along every step of the way. And my mother was the victim in that. My mother was the one that actually had to face some of the repercussions from that towards the end of her life. And that is very unfortunate.
So how did you link up with Roger Stone?
I met Roger. I met Roger actually through some mutual friends of my husband's. My husband had taken me to a dinner in Orlando. And that was actually how I originally met Roger. I met him. He had written one of his books. I don't remember which book he was on at that point. But it was pretty much around the time that Donald Trump was running. It was right around 2015, 2016 that I met Roger. And I immediately thought that he was a brilliant person and a brilliant intellectual human being that I had amazing, interesting historical conversations with. And we developed a friendship because of that. It's that simple.
But professional as well? I mean, did you go into business with him?
No, I didn't go into business with him. I do some things alongside Roger. I've spoken with Roger on stage. I've done different things with Roger that are cohesive for both of us. But I don't work for Roger, and I haven't worked for Roger.
Do you think your association with him caused you trouble?
No, I mean, I think my association as a Trump supporter caused me trouble. Roger just also happens to be a Trump supporter. So I think Roger gets a lot of heat and bad press because of who he is and how he helped the president, you know, win an election. So that's what that stems from with Roger. And yes, he happens to be my friend. And I happen to be friends with a lot of other people that share the same ideals and the same values that I do politically. And I'm very proud of those people for standing up and not giving in when the heat is hot and when they could easily go and run away and hide or hide their political positions or suppress who they are. I'm very proud of Roger for being somebody who's willing to stand up. And I do like to surround myself with people like that. So I would never single Roger out and say he's responsible, but certainly there was an opportunity for them to take another hits at me by putting Roger Stone in the headlines.
And who's they in this case? And I have a sense already, but when you're talking about they're coming. Yeah, who is they? Just the establishment, the swamp. Who?
It's the establishment. It's the swamp. It's the interconnected mainstream media machine that is run by a Democrat agenda in this country, and it's deep and it's murky and it's swampy and it's awful. And it's the main reason why they were able to create a narrative about me that was completely untrue.
Now you're in marketing. You're in marketing, and absolutely, you know, you've got connections, and yep. I mean, you hired a lawyer, right?
I did. Well, you know, I have a husband who's a lawyer. So, you know, in some ways, I guess that's probably a blessing and a curse, right? You know, I had my husband represent me initially, you know, when the guardianship, you know, I didn't think I needed to hire a lawyer right off the bat. I thought it would be something we could handle together. But yeah, of course, down the road, I handled lawyers and, you know, had quite large legal bills over everything that I had to fight. From the political criminal persecution of me to, you know, the other things. I've had to hire quite a few lawyers. So yeah, I'm very familiar with that.
I mean, but you're a strong woman. You're resourceful. You're smart. I mean,
yeah.
And isn't it
interesting? You know, imagine if they've screwed with me the way that they have. And when I say they, yeah, I mean the establishment. If I've endured what I've endured, I can only imagine how difficult it must be for people that, you know, aren't in the position that I'm in. And it's one of the main reasons why with guardianship, I choose to be a voice for change. I choose to go forward because I talk to families every single day that end up so financially and emotionally broken that they aren't able to advocate for themselves anymore. They aren't able to stand up. And after everything that I've been through, you know, the media persecution, through, you know, the criminal persecution, through my mom dying, you know, I'm still here. I'm still here and I'm still fighting. And I always will. And I don't believe that we're supposed to do anything else but that. That's what our country was founded on, is people who are strong, who are willing to stand up. But if they can do it to me, imagine what they're doing to other people.
All right. So at some point you're charged criminally, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tell us about that.
That was horrific. So, yeah, it wasn't anything I would have ever expected would happen to me. I've never had any legal trouble in my life. I've never been in a situation beyond, you know, maybe getting a speeding ticket. And I'm not even sure if I actually had a ticket or I got a warning way back then. But, you know, I never pictured that I would be someone who would be standing in a courtroom being accused of a crime. But there I was. So, you know, things really started to go sideways, you know, once I was sentenced. And actually the first hearing, and I didn't want to be sentenced, the first hearing that we went to, that was when the media spectacle started. And that's when there was all this attention of, you know, Mrs. Florida goes to jail and what's happening. And, you know, just watching these media headlines spin and watching what they were writing about me was really surreal. Like, it put me in just a really bad place, you know, to be able to like to read it and to know that that wasn't what was happening and that none of the things that were in these articles was even remotely true. Some of them were completely fictitious. Some of them were, you know, accusing me of stealing hundreds of thousands of dollars and all sorts of things. And it was just a really weird experience. It wasn't something I was prepared for at all.
All right. So like, fill us in though. What were you formally accused of?
I was accused of a $17,000 misappropriation of Social Security funds. That is what they charged me with. That's what they accused me with. That's what the prosecutor, I took a voluntarily meeting with the prosecutor because I knew it was getting political. I wanted to be represented by somebody that I knew the politics of things, knew people in the courts who would potentially, you know, be able to, you know, navigate the situation because it was weird. It was weird from the beginning. And he was, Guy Fronstein actually had worked on the Epstein case. And at that time, remember, Epstein hadn't killed himself. So he had worked for Epstein. And actually, the magistrate that sentenced me and had my hearing, he also worked for Epstein. So they knew each other. So from the beginning of this, I have my lawyer telling me, you know, I know the magistrate, you know, this is going to be okay, don't worry. And then all of a sudden, I go to the hearing, and it blows up. And there's all these salacious headlines and Roger Stone and I'm a criminal and, you know, all over a $17,000, you know, error on a form that I knew that the prosecutor was going to try to slam me on. And this prosecutor retired right after my case, which I find very interesting. I was her last case and she retired from one. And it just seemed so convoluted, everything, just from, you know, her not being willing to understand, you know, why I would be using Social Security money to pay private duty aides and not even wanting me to hear, you know, what was going on at the nursing home and not wanting to hear how they were abusing my mother and not wanting to hear that my mother had been over medicated. She was insensitive, unfeeling, uncaring, and just, you could tell that she was bent on who I was personally and my politics. There were things that she said within the meeting, you know, within the first meeting with her, within that meeting with my attorney present, you know, she had mentioned Roger Stone and my relationships and my support of Donald Trump and all these other things that had absolutely nothing to do with a $17,000 misdemeanor.
Broad strokes here, $17,000, broad strokes. Like, so my sense is, piecing this together, the 17,000, first of all, your mother has dementia, right? At this point,
my mother has dementia. I'm dementia. Her power of attorney. So I was her power. I was my mother's. Understand? I'm an only child.
Yeah.
and by, you know, when my parents had their power of attorneys, they had done everything when they were in Connecticut and I was the only child. So I thought I had all my ducks in a row. I thought their legal documents were solid, like my stuff was together. So I was taking initiative to be a caregiver for my mother. So if I felt that my mother wasn't getting the care she was needed, yeah, I was using her Social Security money and I was paying private duty aides to go in there and watch the nursing home and make sure that my mother was taken care of. But in the eyes of the feds, you know, when you have a federal prosecutor who happens to know the nursing home and happens to be friendly with people who all of a sudden is like, you know, no matter what, I'm going to charge you with a $17,000 misdemeanor. You're in a situation where you're facing that regardless. You know, it was either that or spend $500,000 trying to fight the system,
and,
which did not seem like a good option.
Okay. It's a federal case or a local case?
This is a federal case.
It's a federal case. Now, federal.
Oh, yeah.
Now, wait, by the way, $17,000, though. Isn't that above, is that grand larceny? Does that make it technically a felony or was always a misdemeanor?
No, it's a misdemeanor.
I've never heard. I thought they didn't do misdemeanor cases.
Honestly, I've never been tried with anything. I'm a federal misdemeanor. And yes, there's very few federal misdemeanors. Now that I know that they exist, I have met other people that have been charged with federal misdemeanors. As a matter of fact, if you look at the people on January 6th, that have been charged and you pull those cases apart, you'll notice that many of them have been charged with federal misdemeanors. And the reason that I believe that they're charging them with federal misdemeanors, and I'm not a lawyer, but again, I'm a logical person who tries to like do my research and figure out what's going on just from the perspective of as a non-lawyer, misdemeanors don't have the same appeals process. They're more difficult to appeal. So that may be one of the reasons that they use these misdemeanor charges. Not sure, don't have anything to validate that besides common sense, but I'm going to apply common sense.
But you had receipts for the aides you paid for.
I had lots of stuff, and everything that I had, I complied and cooperated with everybody from the beginning of this entire thing. There was nothing that I was hiding. There was nothing that I didn't comply with. I complied with everything that was asked of me.
And letter of the law. Letter of the law, they said you did what, though?
Correct.
Letter,
there was a form. It's called a Social Security fiduciary form. And on this particular Social Security fiduciary form, which I was required to fill out as my mother's POA and fiduciary, I had put a charge on a particular line item. You know, it's like filling out a tax return, right? You've got different line items and they're all numbered, right? And each number corresponds to whatever category. The $17,300 that I had applied to this category was not a caregiving category. This category was a food and housing category. And the prosecutor's argument was that I could not have spent that amount on food and housing because the facility that my mother was in was providing her with food and shelter. That was the argument. That was how she was going to nail me. That's how she laid it out. And it was a point that really I could try to explain why I had screwed that up, but they were going to find something. Let's call it what it is. She was going to go through her entire stack of papers and she was going to look for any mistake that Karen Turk had made to turn this into what the result that she wanted. And the problem that we have in this country, and this prosecutor is not alone in this, that you have prosecutors that do not like to lose and they're going to find a way to win no matter what. And that is what I believe happened there. And I will stand by that till the day that I die. They were going to find something. And you want to know what my fear was? You know what my fear was? My fear really was that if they didn't find something in that stack of papers, that what was next? What was next? Were they going to go after my husband? Were they going to tear my family apart? What about my kids? Were they going to go after my adult children next, who had been also caregiving for my mother and showing up at that facility and complaining? Were my kids next on their list? Were they the next target? And you have to understand, like, as a mother in that moment, I just felt to myself, like, I don't have a lot of options here. I have to take this misdemeanor. I have to allow them to think that they won, because otherwise I may be in a situation where this doesn't end. You know, I hate to bring up my friend Roger here, but it's pretty relevant in what I'm saying. Look at Roger and all the times that he stood up and the attacks that have been waged against this man from the Mueller investigation, which we now know so much more about. You know, all the things that came forward in the Durham report, which seemed to really look like there were a lot of things that Donald Trump that was saying were correct, and a lot of things that Roger Stone has been persecuted and prosecuted for that are unfair. So, you know, there's a lot of people in this country. He's not alone. I'm not alone. There's a lot of people in this country that have been mistreated by our justice system. And as long as we have these people who are in power, who are just determined to win at all costs, whether it's fair or not, we're going to be in a situation where we have a really skewed justice system. And where we sit right now, we really do.
Yeah. Amen. I mean, wow. And they have
You think about it. Like, I can't even talk about it. Like, right now I'm getting emotional because it's like I'm sitting there and I'm looking at this woman and I can tell that this woman has no compassion for what's happening to my mother, that my mother's trapped in this guardianship and that they're abusing my mother. And this woman wants to do nothing except go through that stack of papers and find some mistake that I made so she can charge me. And all I can think to myself is, if I don't end this, this is going to get worse. If I don't just lay down and take this at this point, this is going to get worse. And I actually saw Roger the day before my my sentencing, and I had dinner with him. And you know, true to his friendship with me, he said to me, "You're going to get back up from this. This is not the end of you. Like, you're going to get back up from this." And I was like a brave face and do a fundraiser for him because I had committed to doing it. But it was so hard. It was such an incredibly horrific moment, and it's hard to even talk about right now, because when I had that prosecutor, when I sat in that room, I knew for that, at that point, I knew they were against me no matter what, and that I was facing an uphill battle, and I felt that my kids could be next. It's scary.
No, I get it. I really do. This, I can totally see it. I can feel it. I know it.
It sucks.
Can I ask you this? The prosecutor sitting there. And I know, show me the person, I show you the crime. That's how they operate,
yep.
Some of them.
Yeah.
What was it about her? Or what was it about you and her? Was it that she, you know, her friends kind of gave her the wink and the nod, you know, we don't like this person. What was that?
If you read my book, the chapter is called Justice Winks at Her Friends.
Ah.
And you just said it. That's the chapter in my book, Justice Winks at Her Friends. And that is 100% how I feel. I feel that it was an inside job. It was, hey, you're retiring. I need you to go after this woman. I don't know that this happened. I'm just telling you from where I sit how I feel.
Yeah.
How I feel. This could be completely inaccurate in reality, but I'm telling you that my gut is usually right. And here you had, if anything else, let's take out of it, let's say that she wasn't chummy with the nursing home, although I saw them laughing together and watching this happen to me and high-fiving and cheering and being excited about me being taken down. But let's take that all out of it. And let's just say that she was someone who did not politically align with me. She was an older, unhappy, miserable woman who voted for Hillary Clinton. If she's definitely going to have a bone to pick with me, because most of those women do. So we can just profile her right there, take everything else out of the mix and say, maybe that was the only agenda. All I know is I know that I looked into a woman's eyes and I knew no matter what I did, that I was going to be personally slaughtered at this point. And that's exactly what happened.
Yeah. No. Oh, wow. It's interesting that the chapter's named that. I think yep. January 6th, there could have been like, boy, it would be really awful.
I'm on the list.
What do you mean you're on the list? What do you mean?
Oh, you should go back. I'll send it to you. I'll send you the document. I'm on the list for January 6th. I was actually the first round of names that they put out in the press related to January 6th. Only one problem.
You weren't
only
there.
One problem, what? Greg. I wasn't there.
Where were you?
I was in Florida. Speaker. Yeah. I was asked to speak. And I didn't go, but yet they didn't do their homework and me off the list, because all they did was publish the speakers list and say, these are all the people information from the White House on, or intentionally didn't leave me off the list in order to string me up in that story. I don't know, but you could look at it either way.
That's amazing. That is all right. So look, now you pleaded guilty, right?
I took a guilty plea for a $17,000 misdemeanor, correct, I was told, this is the good part, gets better. I was told by my lawyer repeatedly that prosecutors don't go back on plea deals, that I was safe, that plea deals stick, that, you know, look at Epstein, look at the sweet plea deal, you know, that he got back in 2007. Look at what I've done. Look at what I've done. And I don't blame him. I got to tell you something. I like Guy Fronson. I think he's a good lawyer, but I don't think he was prepared for the political climate of 2019. And I don't think he was prepared for my case. And I think he got sideswiped a little bit in the way that things went down. So he assured me repeatedly that they don't go back on plea deals. And I was told I was going to get 6 months of probation and I would pay my fine and I would move on with my life. And next thing I know, I go into sentencing and the magistrate goes rogue and she's running around in a bright purple suit looking like a circus master. And the, you know, the nursing homes in the corner, you know, I'm surprised they weren't serving popcorn. And basically at that point, the magistrate says, you know, I don't normally, and this is all in the transcripts, I don't normally to get an opportunity to send a message to America, but today, because it's you, I now have that opportunity. And I'm going to say that that opportunity is don't steal from the government. And for that, I'm sentencing you to 30 days in a maximum security prison.
Can't be maximum.
Oh, no, no, no. I was in a maximum security prison. Let's clarify exactly where Karen Turk was. Let's make sure that we touch on this. I don't know, again, if this was strategic or what this was about, but they gave me a 30-day sentence, not a 31-day sentence. If they had given me a 31-day sentence and I had been sentenced to a month, from what I would have been placed in a minimum security facility, perhaps even a camp. I would have been placed somewhere in a facility with people for white collar misdemeanor crimes. Instead, because they sentenced me to 30 days instead of 31 days, I didn't get any time off for good behavior or any of that other incentives. Plus, they were able to put me in FDC Miami. FDC Miami is a maximum security detention center located in downtown Miami. It is a lockup facility with no outdoor area. You do not see the light of day. That is where I spent my 30 days. With manslaughterers and gang members and murderers. That's where I was. And I was there for 30 days for a misdemeanor crime.
So I'm sorry. Wow.
It's okay. I mean, it's like, and you know what? You know what the good part about all of this is? The good part about, because I have to find the good, because otherwise it sounds very dark. Even saying it out loud sounds like a very dark situation. But, you know, I went in there and there were so many people on Twitter and on Instagram and on Facebook and people that I knew that had, you know, that I thought were my friends that were talking about me and making comments. And I would go on Twitter and I would read the tweets and they would say things like, I hope Karen Turk gets raped in prison. I hope, you know, they're going to kick her butt because she's a Trump supporter. She's going to get murdered in prison, like every day, all day long. And I went in there and I immediately walked in and was met with this unique situation that I had never been in before with some really tough, really, you know, tough looking women that, you know, would not be someone that I would approach and say hello to on a normal day. And now here I am. And I said, you know what? I'm going to say hello to every single person that I wouldn't normally say hello to. I'm going to spend this 30 days like getting to know people and just trying to make the best of this situation. And not once, not one single time did I have one woman in that facility that was mean to me, treated me badly, or did anything to hurt me. The people I had to worry about were the guards, the male guards coming in and out of the facility in a female lockup where there's only male guards and whether or not they were going to watch us take a shower that day. Those were the things I had to worry about. I didn't have to worry about those women having my back. Every single one of those women was compassionate towards me and nice to me.
It's amazing.
No matter what their crime was.
It's kind of
and
beautiful.
We're talking about people. Yeah, it was beautiful. I mean, we're talking about my roommate was there for manslaughter. She was young. She was was living in Miami Gardens and, you know, comes from a tough family and has had family members in and out of jail. And just a totally different environment. And she got in a knife fight with a girl over a drug deal and ended up stabbing the girl to death. And, you know, called self-defense. They called it murder, whatever it is, you know, manslaughter. And here she is, you know, eight years of her life in facilities and, you know, still just wants to listen to Carrie Underwood and eat potato chips and talk about, you know, when she gets out and when she goes home. And, you know, I feel really lucky to be able to have gotten to know this person who so many people would just judge at surface level and say, you know, she made this mistake. She's, you know, a terrible person. And, you know, she killed this girl. But, you know, I was living with her. I mean, I was in her room, you know, I had to respect it was her room before I got there. And I really, you know, everything that I got to know about her, she was someone who made a mistake when they were really young and put herself in a stupid situation and was paying a really hefty price for it. And, you know, I got to know a whole other side of her, and I feel really lucky and blessed for that.
Do you feel like totally out of the woods? My fear is for you, for me, for other people who are politically active, like they could come after you again.
Yeah, they can. They can lock me up, but they'll never shut me up. That's my new tagline. That's what I tell myself. But yeah, it does scare me. It scared me when I saw my name published on that January 6th list. And I thought about, you know, God forbid I had gone to D.C. I think I was still technically on probation at that point. I mean, imagine the example they could have made of me. You know, even if I did virtually nothing, even if I just stood outside the Willard Hotel and shook hands with Roger Stone, you know, look at what they did to him. So, yeah, I do live every day sort of in the back of my mind that if they want to get you, they're going to find something. If they want to rip your taxes apart and get you on something, they're going to get you. Like they're going to probe you until they get you if they want to. But all we can hope is somehow we get control of this system. I think I mentioned earlier when we were talking, I did this whole piece yesterday on George Soros, and that George Soros is funding all these district attorney races on a local level throughout the country. And it's not really something that had ever occurred to me before, just how influenced our district attorneys are and our prosecutors by who's gotten them in and who's, you know, making these donations to political campaigns. And here you have George Soros that's funding all these DA races. Our justice system is biased, it's transparent, it's evident, and we're on the other side of that. So I can't live in fear. But yeah, I always have in the back of my mind, like, if they're going to get you, they're going to get you. And yeah, am I making myself a target by still being in, you know, and still, you know, supporting Donald Trump and supporting his agenda to put America first? Yeah, maybe a little bit, but will I pay that price every day to make sure that my kids are going to grow up in a free country? Yeah, I will. And I don't know how else to do it, but it does scare me that that's a reality.
Yeah, I think that's what happened. She was penalized for having the wrong friends and the wrong point of view. And things can happen. You know, is there an email from some government official saying, let's get this person? No. But a wink and a nod? I know it. All right. So her name again, Karen Turk. We thank you, Mrs. Turk. And the story can be found in her book, Behind the Headlines: How a Conservative Beauty Queen Became the Target of Fake News and Cancel Culture. All right. It is available now wherever books are sold. But yeah, let me know if you need help finding it. It's on Amazon and in other places as well. Amazon, we're counting on you to be a benevolent company. All right. Don't let us down. We already have concerns, but all right. And then, of course, there are booksellers everywhere. But all right. In the meantime, thank you. And thank you to D'Espresso LeBaire. All right. We're coming up on the holidays. Merry Christmas. Happy Hanukkah. Whatever faith you celebrate, I do hope you celebrate your faith. If you don't, get in the Word of God. It's an amazing experience. I was counting on myself for many, many years. And why not count on God? He is... Well, I know he's perfect, and I'm not, and neither are you. No offense. All right. So, but the perfect gift for your friends and loved ones could be D'Espresso LeBaire. All right. The pleasure of waking up every morning to a savory micro-roasted cup of coffee that supports quality coffee farmers, America's special operations community, and our great country. Visit D'EspressoLeBaire.com. All right, we're going to do this spelling thing again. D'EspressoLeBaire.com. D, like duh, D-E, espresso, LeBaire, L-I-B-E-R, D'EspressoLeBaire.com. It's got to put it on the notes on the website and on iTunes. It is a veteran-owned, family-run, small business whose brew tastes as good as it will make you feel. After all, freedom doesn't brew itself. Merry Christmas, everybody, and we will talk soon. Many thanks.